This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 27th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 305. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, BC's record summer of wildfires continues. Firefighters now have the upper hand around Kelowna, but it's a different story elsewhere. According to experts, BC needs to learn to live with wildfire and prevent it from spreading out of control by managing forests better. My guest is John Rustad, the leader of the Conservative Party of BC. Is it just me, or is Prime Minister Justin Trudeau hoping and praying for another national emergency to come along so that everybody just stops asking him why it's taking so long to call a public inquiry into China's meddling in Canadian elections? The biggest story out of Ottawa this year, and it's lasted three seasons, plus one special rapporteur. What a disaster that was. This is what Trudeau and Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre said last week.
We continue to work very closely with all opposition parties on making sure that the terms of reference, the person who will be leading it, and the work that is done is in the best interests of all Canadians, that they are able to do the work without the kind of partisan toxicity we saw during the fall. We know that a robust inquiry into foreign interference of all different types is really important for democracy, and that's why we're moving forward with that.
What's the holdup on calling this inquiry in your mind? Because he says you haven't come to a consensus yet.
We gave him names, we gave him a mandate, and we've been waiting ever since. The holdup is Justin Trudeau. Only Justin Trudeau has the authority to call a public inquiry. As leader of the opposition, I have no authority under the Inquiries Act. I've made my suggestions and I'm now waiting for him. You almost wonder if Trudeau doesn't want the truth to come out about Beijing's interference in our democracy before the next election so that he can allow that interference to happen all over again.
Of course, if Trudeau really doesn't want to call the public inquiry that people across the spectrum want, he could simply just resign. Resign the leadership, resign as prime minister, give it to someone else. Public opinion polls are no longer going his way after almost 8 years in power. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Another long, hot, costly record summer of wildfires around British Columbia. The good news is that firefighters have the blazes around Kelowna under control, but more than 200 houses are gone. The Forest Practices Board is the independent watchdog. It reported in June that BC needs to move towards what's called landscape fire management. In a nutshell, fire is part of nature and money is better spent on keeping it from going out of control. Forest Practices Board has been calling for change for years. BC spends an average $200 million a year to fight wildfires, but between 2005 and 2015, BC spent only $60 million total on wildfire prevention. Over 96.3 million acres of public land are at high or extreme risk for wildfire in BC. Since 2018, only 64,000 acres, or 1% of wildland-urban interface, have been treated at a cost of $72 million. My guest this week is Conservative Party of BC leader John Rustad. John Rustad is the MLA for Nechaco Lakes. He's a former Minister of Forests and Minister of Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation in the BC Liberal government until 2017. He also worked in the forest industry. John, first of all, the big question, what is your reaction to the NDP's handling of this crisis?
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on. And you know, when I look at this, I think history is repeated. We saw this in 2017, we saw this in 2018, we saw this in 2021, and we're seeing it again. And I for the life of me, I just cannot understand how the ministry hasn't learned lessons. You know, when you have a fire that and you have a major wind event, really, with the dry conditions we've got, with the fuel loads that have been built up over so many decades, you're going to have big problems. There's no way, you know, to be able to stop it. But the approach that we're taking just really makes me shake my head. Why did we not? We knew the event was coming. Why didn't we declare a state of emergency in advance? Why didn't we bring in structural protection units? Why didn't we set up, mass water delivery systems in advance, you know, days in advance, and soaking the area? Like, there's just so many things that could have been done. And, you know, there was one case back in 2018 where I asked about, you know, putting in a mass water delivery system and turning it on. And they said, well, but it's so expensive. And I just, you know, with the amount of money that we spend as government, money should not be the object when we're talking about saving people's homes, properties, and you know, their lives, what they've worked into. It's just, so it's frustrating to see that, you know, we really haven't changed over the years, even with these major fire events that we're seeing.
Now, the response since then has been quite voluminous. We've seen fire trucks and firefighters from around the province join the BC Wildfire Service, a BC Wildfire Service, which is relying on a lot of personnel from other countries, from other continents. What are you seeing in this whole operation, and how can they be doing better?
Well, I think, you know, we've got lots of contractors that are involved. There's personnel from all around. When you declare a state of emergency, essentially what that doing is saying that as a province, there is now one fire department, one overall arching structure. And what that does is it allows you to be able to draw resources from communities from around the province, fire trucks, structural protection units, crews, into an area to be able to fight a fire. Unfortunately, what ends up happening with government is they wait until basically the barn is burnt down, and then they call for the reinforcements, as opposed to saying, boy, there's a fire coming towards the barn. Why don't we call the reinforcements in advance to try to prevent the barn from being burnt down? And it's just, I don't know why we operate that way, but it is the way they operate. The other thing is, you know, when you've got a fast moving fire that is up in the trees, it's a category 5 or 6, maybe even a category 4. And when there's an order to evacuate, get out, because that fire is going to be moving so fast. And particularly if you're in a wooded area, you're not going to have a chance. When it's below that, a rank maybe 3 or 4, maybe a rank 2 fire, you know, you've got a chance to protect, because that's a fire that's on the ground and you can actually do something to protect. If you've properly fire smarted your house, you've got a sprinkler system in place around there, you know, you can stay. The ministry says, please don't stay, because they don't want to see anybody put at risk. But you've got a fighting chance that, you know, if you do stay behind. The challenge I have seen, and I saw this in all those previous years, is there are some people that just decide they want to stay behind. They want to fight for their home. They want to fight for their property. I get that. And people should have the right to be able to do that. But they shouldn't be blockaded. They should be able to have supplies that are able to come in. They should be able to have, you know, there's friends, there's other people that try to bring pumps, hoses, and they're not allowed to bring it into these people. You know, they rely on each other and neighbors to put out spot fires, and they're getting no support. That should not happen. And I get that, you know, it's difficult for the ministry, because when you have people out there that are not part of the unit, you don't know what they're doing, you don't know where they are, it makes it difficult to coordinate air support. It also makes, you know, difficult to be able to coordinate your efforts on the ground. But that doesn't mean that you should, you know, put a spike bar across a road and prevent anybody from going in to help. That you should, you know, have a boat out stopping people coming in by water to build support. We had a situation back in 2018 in my riding across south side of Francois Lake, where there was an evacuation order, and there was hundreds of people that stayed behind to fight the fires, to fight for their properties. And the police actually, and I don't blame the police on this because they were ordered to do this, but they blockaded the road. They weren't allowed to use the ferry across. People were running supplies at night. People punched in a road on the east side of the lake so they could get around and drive into the area. Contractors were smuggling, supplies in for people. I mean, that's crazy. What is government doing? Why would they take this approach instead of saying, you know, look, we don't want you there. Maybe you got to sign a waiver because we don't want the legal responsibility. But you know, what do we need? What can we get you to help? You know, so that they could actually be able to be effective. I just don't understand why our government refuses to be able to engage with people that want to stay behind and see them as an asset as opposed to seeing them as a liability.
And we talk about the legacy of the last several years, you know, from 2017 onwards, but this summer is 20 years since a similar large forest fire in the area of Kelowna, which had some devastating effects on the region back then. And here we are 20 years later, and it's in some ways a repeat, in some ways a repeat of the same issues.
You know, there was a report that was done back then called the Filman Report, and it laid out, you know, a very comprehensive plan in terms of how to try to prevent these fires. Realistically, it could never be implemented. It was way too expensive in terms of the implementation of what they were trying to do. But there were components of it that should have been looked at. For example, back in 2003, the Wildfire Service didn't really look at structural protection units as being the thing they wanted to focus on. And after they were proven out in 2003 because of local fire departments, now the Wildfire Service says, oh, well, maybe we'll start using them. And they're very slow to be able to adapt to technology, unfortunately. But one of the big things that we need to be thinking about, you know, when you look at our landscape just in general, most of British Columbia, most of the interior British Columbia, northern interior, southern interior, fire has been the dominant factor on the landscape for thousands of years. Trees adapt to fire. Pine cones open when you have fire coming through. Fir trees have a thick bark to be able to protect themselves from fire, right? So you have these types of vegetation that is designed to manage fire. But we have removed fire from the landscape. We don't allow to use it in the landscape. And what is happening with that is the fuel loads start to build up. You can get more and more material so that when you do get dry conditions and you get a fire, you get something that's catastrophic. And that's something we need to think about, especially for the interface areas between communities and forests. You know, I live out in the middle of out on a lake, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. I've got lots of wildlife, lots of trees and stuff around. I'm chosen to live that way. People like to be able to live as close to nature as they can, but we need to be able to make sure if that's the case, we need to put a plan in place in terms of how you structure the interface area so that you remove these fuel loads so that you've got a fighting chance to be able to stop these fires. In addition to that, how we manage on the landscape needs to be thought about. How can you create natural breaks? How do we use fire back on the landscape to make sure that there are natural breaks? How do we look at different species as we're logging, as we're planting, to change how, you know, fires can interact on the landscape? There are things that we should have been doing decades ago. And I remember I mentioned to the Ministry of Forest back in 2008 when I had fires in my riding that we should be looking at these kind of patterns or these kind of changes. And we never did. That was never being considered. Just, you know, bureaucracy is very slow to change, unfortunately.
And we do also have governments which look for easy answers or want the soundbite. And we saw it this week, you know, David Eby blaming things on climate change. While, you know, the climate is changing, we are having longer summers, hotter summers, and when fires happen, they're more intense. When in fact, they're not spending on the management, the prevention, the mitigation. And if they're going to talk about climate change all the time, they can also spend on adaptation. There are other aspects that they're not paying attention to. Is this just a cop-out in your mind that the politicians keep employing?
Look, there's no question that the climate is changing. I mean, nobody can deny that. We've seen that, you know, in a variety of ways. But just to say that that is the problem, is very naive to even suggest that. Yes, you might have warmer conditions, you might have changing conditions, more intensity, but the reality is, back in the early 1950s, we got good at putting out fires. And so trees got older than they normally would have on the landscape. Fuel loads built up a lot higher than they normally would have on the landscape. And back in my life before politics, I actually mapped fire patterns from 100 Mile House to Mackenzie, from McBride out to Smithers, to look at the patterns on the landscape over 160 to 200 year period and how fires had interacted there. And you could see in the 1950s where it stopped because we got good at putting out fires. So we didn't have these events, which changed, of course, the very nature of the landscape. We've stopped, you know, when we do harvest, we stop doing broadcast burns on the block, so the fuel loads stay in the block. We do some pile and burning, but the reality is there's still lots of fuel left in the blocks for when these fires get going, when we're doing harvesting on the landscape. So climate is changing is definitely part of it. But simply to say climate change is the problem is like virtue signaling. It's not talking about the reality of what's actually happening on the landscape.
The government instead has just spent hundreds of millions of dollars every year on fighting the fires instead of adapting to the fires and managing the fires and the forests.
Well, like I say, it gets to the place where you really need to start talking about the priorities in terms of how we manage the landscape. But you know, as we talk about this, Bob, I don't want to take away from the fact that there are tens of thousands of people that have been significantly impacted by these fires. Right? I mean, it's tragic when you think about it. We need to make sure we get everything we can in there to support these people, to get them so they can get their lives back together, to be able to rebuild. But long term, yes, we need to think about changing how we manage on the landscape. There was a piece of legislation that the NDP brought in called that create these forest landscape plans that are on a large scale that are supposed to start including fire. But the problem is these things are going to take 3 to 5 years or longer to implement for any one particular watershed. And so, but it's at least a start. But I'm still not seeing that there's a heavy focus on rethinking how we are managing on the landscape. And it's, you know, because of that, we've lost tremendous amounts in terms of homes, in terms of some infrastructure, but also a huge amount in terms of our forest. And there's a follow-up as well that needs to be thought about. After a fire is burned through an area, the slopes, the soils are now vulnerable to erosion. You need to get a new growth in there as quick as possible to stabilize the area. You need to be able to take out these dead trees. There are trees that have been damaged from the fire. They should be out and being harvested. And in, for example, in the area of Merritt from the fires from 2021, it was 2 years and Aspen planers couldn't get a permit. They couldn't get access to actually harvesting this wood because the government wouldn't issue the permits. And that's, you know, this stuff has got a 3 to 5 year shelf life at max before it basically falls down and it's gone. We need to be more thoughtful about how we manage on the landscape, both before wildfires happen, but also after wildfires happen, to make sure that we minimize, you know, what some of those challenges are for our landscape.
Now, in 2017, we saw that was the summer coincided with the change in government. There were people throughout the province that were wondering what happened to their properties, why their properties didn't get the firefighting they needed. People lost everything. They tried to find out. They tried to use the Freedom of Information Law to get documents and were met with very large invoices from the NDP government at the time and the Liberal opposition, number of MLAs. You were one of them that fought for the people to try to get information so they could find out what went on for insurance purposes, or at least just peace of mind, just to know how it all happened that summer. And we're probably going to have the same thing in the months to come, people asking government to show what was done and why things were done and why things were not done. Of course, there's also going to be calls from people who have been affected for the assistance that they need. What steps should the government take after learning from previous disasters when people have asked for information, as well as when people have asked for that help to put their lives back together?
You know, so government has made some changes over the years in terms of communication during fire events and getting information out there, more coordination between First Nations and communities, these types of things. But the reality is this, and you follow politics for a long time, political parties and governments like to operate in the shadows. They don't want all of the facts and information to be out there because they want to be able to spin. And quite frankly, this is why we need to dramatically change freedom of information. We should actually be voluntarily providing all the information that we can. And the job of the Freedom of Information Officer should be saying what can't be released. This is the public's information. You shouldn't have to, you know, put in an application and pay a fee to get access to it. You know, the world has changed dramatically since that legislation was first written 30 years ago. So, but I mean, that's one component. But, you know, in 2017, there's a couple of stories from 2017, 2018 I want to relate to you. There was a, and this is one of the big challenges the ministry has, because they will not allow any action on the landscape until they've had their crews in to do assessment and then come up with a plan. So in 2017, there was a CAT operator loaded up his equipment. He was done with one particular area. He was about to leave an area, and he noticed a small fire. It was about 20 hectares up on a hillside. And there was a ministry person there. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he stopped and said, "Hey, you know, I could take my CAT off of the low bed. I could get a fire guard around that tonight. Can I do that?" And the ministry person said, "No, I can't allow you. I can't authorize you to do that. And we need to go and need to put in a plan, do an assessment, and then we'll decide how we want to attack this fire." So the guy waited around. The ministry person left. So he ignored the order, took his CAT off of the low bed, went and worked through the night and put a guard around it. And he was loading up his CAT the next morning back onto the low bed when the ministry person came out again. And the ministry person looked and said, "Thank you so much for doing this. I could never have authorized you to do it." Back in 2018, Interfor told this story. Actually, in January 2019, they told the story, but from the fires of 2018, there was a fire that started up on the hillside in an area where they had crews working. They called the ministry and said, "Look, we've got trained crews. We can get up there right now and attack it and put it out." And the ministry said, "Okay, thanks for letting us know. Please wait, hold off. We're going to send somebody to have a look." So the next day they called again. "Well, we've got somebody coming." The next day they called again. The fourth day they called and said, "Look, we've got to get people up there and action this thing now." And the ministry said, "If you do that, you will be held liable and we will sue you. You're not allowed to go in there until we've been able to go in and do an assessment." Well, by day seven, nobody had showed up, but the wind finally picked up and the fire took off and spread, you know, dramatically. It became a 1,000-hectare fire. Now somebody from the ministry showed up. Those guys could have been in there and had that fire out, but they were not authorized to, because, you know, ministry's worried about liability. They're worried about, you know, people going in, you know, without the ministry's approval and plans. We have to change how we attack these fires. We have to change how we allow this to be working on the landscape.
And finally, we talked about preparation, prevention, mitigation, response. There's the next step is the rebuild. And I'm sure some of the people who have lost everything in the past couple of weeks are very familiar with Lytton and what happened in Lytton in 2021 and what has really not happened since. That those properties in Lytton are still waiting for rebuild. A big question, especially in this day and age when politicians love to talk about building back better. Well, you can't get better if you don't start to build back. And they're not building back in Lytton fast enough. Will they do anything in Kelowna?
Yeah, you know, and that's a very good question. You know, there's insurance issues associated with that. There's a number of things. There's lots of questions, you know, that insurance companies will have about backburns. And, you know, you always hear these stories about backburns starting and going wrong and people losing homes and things like that. But the reality is we should be prioritizing getting permits done, getting these people allowed to start rebuilding their lives. We shouldn't have them have to wait. Like what's gone on in Lytton, I just find is so completely unacceptable. People's lives have been on hold now for over 2 years. They haven't been able to start the rebuild. They haven't been able to do this. They haven't been able to line up contractors. There's, you know, statutes of liability associated with insurance. You know, are those about to run out? You know, why is this happening? And this, you know, we've asked these questions of government. We've asked them in the legislature, and government does not have a good explanation of what they're doing. I'm not sure if there was, you know, archaeological interests, some other sort of factor. I don't know why they haven't allowed that community to be rebuilt. We're seeing in, you know, some other areas where people have some frustration around these things as well, but it should be a priority. I mean, at the end of the day, somebody, you know, fortunately we haven't lost any lives, and that is just so thankful that people got out, the message got out to people, they were able to evacuate in time and make sure that, you know, we didn't have that sort of disaster that we saw in places like Maui. But there's still many structures that have been lost, and people will want to start putting their lives back together. They can't just live in temporary housing for years. They need to be able to start rebuilding. There's only so many contractors we have. There's only so much capacity we have. We can't just do it all at once. You have to get people in there and start the process, you know, and build it out. And whether, you know, I know one person is talking about wanting to come in and put in a log house because he can get it up quickly while he's rebuilding his home. Why aren't we trying to figure out how to support people to do these types of steps? And it's, like I say, it comes down to the ministry. It needs to get actually getting permits out the door, get these things happening so that people can rebuild their lives. And I think government, quite frankly, should be held responsible for that, particularly for what's going on in Lytton. I just think they've been able to limp along, the government has, that is, and just, you know, avoid any real hard questions on it. And I don't quite understand why.
That was my guest, John Rustad, the MLA for Nechako Lakes. He is the leader of the Conservative Party of BC.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan's president warns of China's expansionism in South China Sea. Tsai Ing-wen says to maintain peace, we must first strengthen ourselves. The president made a visit to the frontline island of Kinmen. Triton is midway between Vietnam and the Chinese island province of Hainan. It is part of the Paracel Islands and Taiwan. Satellite photos taken in August by Planet Labs PBC Imaging Service suggest the 1.2 kilometer by 0.5 kilometer island additions could be a levee or a road. In Kyoto news, Japan fisheries industry wraps Fukushima water release as high-handed. The fishery industry in Japan wrapped the discharge of treated radioactive water from the crippled Fukushima nuclear complex into the sea starting Thursday as a high-handed decision, rammed through despite their opposition, while consumers urged the government to give a more detailed explanation of the safety measures in place. Meanwhile, retailers in some parts of China ran out of salt on Thursday as Japan's release of treated radioactive water from the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant in the Pacific Ocean prompted Chinese consumers to hoard the item. In ABC News Australia, Wakari White Island criminal trial hears evidence from brothers who inherited a volcano. The court heard the story about how a deal done in 1936 saw New Zealand's most active volcano become a private asset passed down through generations of the Buttle family. The three brothers who inherited the island are among 13 parties charged with breaches of New Zealand's workplace health and safety laws for allegedly not doing enough to understand and manage the risks to tourists and other people on the island. The volcano erupted in December 2019, killing 22 people. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, man who tried to open door on Portland-bound plane in attention grab to address COVID-19 vaccines gets time served. Michael Brandon DeMar, 32, was a passenger on Delta Airlines Flight 1580 from Utah to Portland in February 2022 when he approached an exit door, removed a plastic safety cover from the door's handle, and repeatedly pulled on the handle. Three flight attendants moved DeMar away from the door, blocked his access to other emergency exits, and made sure he remained in his seat for the rest of the flight. In King 5, amid a fentanyl crisis, Lane Staley's mother still drumming up support for addiction recovery resources. The Kirkland lead singer of Alice in Chains would have turned 56 years old this week. Staley's mother, Nancy McCallum, wrapped up her annual meet and greet with Alice in Chains fans last weekend. Every August since Staley's death, she meets with grunge fans from around the world at the Seattle Center's fountain to celebrate his life with flowers and candles. New King County data shows the fentanyl crisis may be getting worse. Paramedics in King County responded to 65% more overdose calls in the first half of 2023. In the Times Colonist, Butchart Gardens cancels final two fireworks shows of the season. The gardens continue to be open for its full summer hours, and other scheduled activities are going ahead. But the attraction said in a statement that this Saturday's show and the fireworks finale of the season on September 2nd have both been called off. Butchart Gardens had previously canceled its August 19th fireworks show, a day after the province declared a state of emergency over wildfires ranging across the province amid extremely dry conditions. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Square, Round, and Clog Dancers. Yeah, spin your partner round and round, dozy-do, and all that jazz. It is Square, Round, and Clog Dance Awareness Week in BC until September 2nd. Enjoy! You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
You do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do, 'cause your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end, 'cause the rich men know the rich men.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 27th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 27th of August in 1955, the first edition of the Guinness Book of Records was published in Britain? Guinness Book of Records and museums are now owned by West Vancouver's Jim Pattison. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, you can visit us at The Breaker News on Twitter, and if you're outside of Canada, visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. If you're inside of Canada because of Bill C-18, because of the Trudeau Liberals, we're sorry, you're out of luck. Write your local MP. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.